Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the GnomeCast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with game designers about gaming things, so I guess we'd better be good. Today, we have me, Jared Rasher, the Review Gnome, and we've got an interview with a designer we think you'll enjoy. Today, we've got an interview with a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself for us today?
Yeah, my name is Rob Hainso, and I'm a game designer and occasionally an art director, which is what I've been doing right now on 13th Age 2nd Edition. Worked at a variety of game companies and other places with crazy names like Chaosium and Eclectic Institute, which I'm sure you never heard of because it was a vitamin and herb company.
I was just saying, that one I have not heard of.
Yeah, I know. But it fits in with the like Eclectic. What the heck? Chaosium, what? Yeah, the first time I remember when I heard Wizards of the Coast's name, I think I told my wife Lisa there was a company called Wizards of the Coast. And when Magic came out, we played a lot. But she could never say the words Wizards of the Coast without going, Wizards of the Coast! And it was, yeah, so ending up working there later was wonderfully ironic. That's the introduction. What else do you want?
Besides the companies you've worked for, what are some of the games that people might know you from?
13th Age, most recently, Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition, and the Forgotten Realms campaign setting for 3rd Edition I helped with. Three Dragon Ante, the card game played in taverns all across the D&D world with dragon cards, which I'm happy to see was in the most recent editions of D&D, they still have Three Dragon Ante sets as part of the accoutrement of a gambler. That's amazing.
When my daughter was making up her character for our Ravenloft game, she was like, what is Three Dragon Ante? I was like, I have a box to show you.
All right. Excellent. Three Dragon Ante, I did a bunch of other little card games when I was at Wizards. Shadow Fist, I was involved with Feng Shui, the RPG back. That was like my first jobs. Shadowrun Crossfire board game, I helped do with my company Fire Opal. WrestleNomicon is a two-player game of Cthulhu versus Haster, sort of professional wrestling and destroying the universe as a side effect. So, I keep busy.
A few things, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a couple more. Like, one of them coming out in 2025 will be Armello, which was a kickstarted electronic digital game from a company in Australia, League of Geeks, which then I got to do a board game of for Campaign Coin. No, what is King of the Castles, their name when they're doing the board games. It's a deck building quest combat game of funny animals just fighting to see who will be king. Sometimes when you do a design, it just comes out because that's how you did it, right? And I think in the case of Armello, for example, my friends and partners in Fire Opal really did a really good job of developing it. So the gameplay, hilariously, the gameplay is incredibly more fun right now than it did when we did the Kickstarter, which is good because now it's done and it's going to production. So I was like very amused by like seeing, oh yeah, we made, it's like one of those times where you're like, I've got a paper to turn in on Monday. Well, Sunday night. No, it's not true. We worked on it the whole time, but it just got so much better in the last minute where we really figured out some stuff. So that's a good game that's going to be coming out, and there's more that I don't even think have been announced. But 13th Age 2nd Edition has been a lot of what I've been working on recently, along with Jonathan Tweed as co-designer. And my friend Lee Moyer is co-art director.
In the off chance that someone had never heard of 13th Age, which they definitely should have by now, what's your pitch to explain what 13th Age is to people?
I am so bad at elevator pitches. So I remember when Robin Laws was like talking to me about this early on, I would say things like, Robin, it's a D20 rolling game using indie storytelling techniques, but it's designed by the people who did the 3rd and 4th editions of Dungeons and Dragons. It's the game we want to play together on Wednesday nights instead of whatever we made for the man. That's my pitch, And Robin would tell me that's not a pitch. And I would
say, I have an idea what you're talking about.
And I would say, well, it seems to be working for me. So I'm sticking with it. That's basically the pitch. I mean, it's different from many other games in that it only provides a half-designed world. It really is asking every campaign that the players and the GM cooperate to fill in pieces that are different and new for their campaign. We don't set out to create canon. We sort of want people to like surprise each other. And the mechanisms in the game, the storytelling mechanisms also help that. which you'll probably ask about mechanics at some point. I can mention what those are. The game succeeds, I think, partially because we tried to make it a blend for the people who like mechanical crunch. There's enough going on that they can make interesting decisions, but combat is really streamlined. You're not dealing mm-hmm. with counting spaces and all the stupid stuff in combat. It takes time. You're pretty much moving quickly. You're making serious decisions about which powers to use, spells to use when and why, because there's enough crunch that makes it different. Like when you choose to use them really does make a difference. Plus, the storytelling stuff works for the storytellers at the table. It's an odd game that manages to do both. And it's also full of some techniques that I think we wanted other... When we designed it, we weren't designing a line. We thought we were doing just one book. We were wrong.
I jumped on when I backed the second book. So.
That's funny. We intended it to be sort of a toolbox for people to take things like the escalation die and the way we handle skills with backgrounds and stuff and use them in other games. Because we're like, this is probably how fourth edition should have been handled, you know, with an escalation die. Like, absolutely. I ran fourth edition for Peter Atkisson is doing a fun series. He had all the different designers, as many as possible, the different editions, run a game for him. I ran the fourth edition one. Did I use the escalation die? I did. There's no fun running fourth edition without that. Like every round, the escalation die counts up a point and only the player characters get to add that to their attacks. Mm-hmm. So basically the dramatic curve means that you can start a battle way too hard and have people feeling like, oh no, but they'll pull it out in the end.
Having played it quite a bit, I really do appreciate that it is an interesting shift there. Also, having played fourth edition, I agree. I would have liked something like that to move things along every once in a while.
Yeah. It's odd. The origins of that escalation die are a little murky, except I'm pretty sure Mike Failhour, a friend, did it first. Except I also know that I had done something. I don't know. I think he did it on his own. I had done something like it, but I'd only given it to certain monsters. I hadn't given it to the player characters. So it was sort of like, who knows? But Mike definitely did it early, and we brought it on. And if I wish I'd, when I was working in fourth edition, I wish I thought of it then. I see. Remember meetings I had with people about combat dragging and not quite getting there.
You mentioned the setting for 13th Age, and it's funny because I was just listening to a podcast a few days ago and people talking about what setting design looks like and how it hasn't really evolved since the beginning of RPGs. Huh. And I immediately thought of 13th Age as like, this is different than other campaign settings that I have seen. And I like that because there's enough guidance that when you start playing, you don't feel like you're making everything up, but right. also you don't worry about whether whether the Dragon Emperor has a brother or not, you know, because.
Well, actually, you can make it up. I mean,
yeah,
there's the
exactly.
Like, do you want him to have a brother? And if the answer is yes, well, then you're probably not impinging on anybody else's sense of the game, mm-hmm. if you say so. Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, I describe the approach as pillars. Like, we have certain pillars, which are definitely the icons, the big fantasy archetypes. Mm-hmm. But we don't want even to tell you necessarily. A lot of the second edition of the game, much of the GM advice, for example, is about setting up your campaign. And it's about telling you, well, maybe you want to surprise the player characters by changing the moral valence of a few of these icons, you know, or maybe maybe your players want to do that. It was very interesting at the start of running the line to find that almost of our freelancers were accustomed to designing game RP role-playing material in which they told the audience exactly what things were like. Mm-hmm. And that was viewed as, your work was viewed as incomplete if you didn't. You know, mm-hmm. No, in 13th Age, we're like, we're not even telling the story. We're letting the players tell the story, and therefore we want to leave a lot of stuff to that decision. I think the thing is, the difference is you have to sort of know where you're incomplete and make it in interesting ways and mm-hmm. set people up with potentially interesting answers as examples. If you just leave it incomplete and don't help people, people read it and go, oh, that was pretty flat. But the idea that we try to do is we try to make every page interesting and exciting. There's some reason to read a page. You know, mm-hmm. if you finish a page and there was no reason to read it, whoops, that was a mistake. So
I really like that feeling that even... You know, you talk about the icons being basically iconic archetypical characters, but I like the fact that a lot of the places are also very archetypical. Like, you may not have a ton of detail on a city, but you know if you want to have a story about smugglers and crime, you would use this city here because that's the archetype of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's, you're right. That is, and that's the kind of thing. You're playing with the themes. And because fantasy gaming has been around long enough that many people can also play with the themes, it's fun for them to do that. And it's empowering. There is something fun about a Forgotten Realms campaign setting where people are like, oh, I'm playing in a world and other people are playing the exact same world. And we really care. And in the old days, we'd be like, and what's going to happen with the Dale lands? You know, which of the Dales is going to be overrun? But, you know, the 13th Age approach is a lot more, we know that every campaign is going to have a really different take on things. And we also know that game masters and players who invent things that are fun for everyone else at the table feel great and feel special. And so there are actually times where we've written things that we've cut because we're like, you know, this is really good. But the truth is, it's also the kind of really good that almost anybody could come up with. And therefore, they're going to. And we just need to get out of the way. You know, obviously, sometimes we step right into that. But there are other times where it's like, you don't say the obvious riff because people will really enjoy doing the obvious riff.
I was just going to say it's not in the main line, but I was just going to, for years I had heard about Glorantha.
Yeah.
And it always was very intimidating, and the most interested I became it was going through 13th Age of Glorantha because you presented the themes first and foremost. It wasn't specifically the weight of history hitting you all at once. It was like, this is what the setting does.
Yes. Glorantha was probably on our mind when we did 13th Age and the pillars approach we're talking about. That is how we approach Glorantha. It's like, we know these are the gods and we know these are the pantheons, but we do not want players to have to know what happened with this particular sect of the Sundown Temple in year 1325. The lore is there and it's wonderful, but I personally don't think it helps gamers run their own games. And so, yeah, we took a deliberately very different slant on Glorantha than RuneQuest, for example. And when we started, RuneQuest wasn't really back yet. So we were something different anyway, and we were really different. Although I think that in some ways, I'm not sure I can speak to this completely, but Robin's Hero Quest could have been the kind of game, that same type of game with a certain pillars and everything. But a lot of the support material that was done acted like it was RuneQuest and you wanted to know everything. So,
yeah,
it's a little bit like the game system was one thing and then the implementation was another, perhaps. So
I really liked the emphasis on like the God time and everything, because it was kind of stressing the idea that this may be true right now, but it may not be true eventually.
Yes.
And I kind of like that approach to things. That's why, I mean, not to get too far off track, but when I was running the One Ring, the thing I kept stressing to people is all of the stories that we know were written by hobbits. That's not necessarily how everything exactly went. So I feel a little bit more comfortable saying this is how this game's going to go.
Nice. I like that. Hopefully all your players weren't hobbits, all your characters.
No, just one.
Just one who I hope held the line. No, this is not. Oh, dear.
So you were talking about every page being fun to read. So I wanted to ask, at what point did you decide to keep all of the design commentary in the book? Because I love that part of 13th Age.
Wow. At what point did we decide? Okay. I'm definitely not going to be able to answer the question and say, this is the point where we decided. I think it was probably really early on, because it's just really natural for us to do that, because we are writing things back and forth in the draft anyway. Like when we're exchanging files, you know, we'll say, what are you doing here? This, what do you mean? You know, what's the example of this? And then at certain times when you get down, so it's pretty likely it was very early on, especially because there's other things to consider. It's not just a textual element, it's also a graphic element. And pages want to be graphic. So as you're doing something like that, the fact that we could go ahead and make a little symbol for Rob says and Jonathan says meant that, you know, it bumped all the way to the top. And for all I know, now I can act like, oh, that's me being smart, but it's entirely possible that was Lee Moyer, like, who saw that and was like, you're not just going to say Rob says, are you got to be kidding me? You know, just where's your symbol? You know, and I'm like, oh, that could have been Lee. But also, but again, the great part is, I don't really know. I got nothing. I'm not sure. I mean, it's very probable that even if I tried to go back to the earliest drafts, if I went back to the earliest drafts and I found it, I would be like, oh, hey, look. But, you know, it was pretty early on.
It almost feels to me like, and I do not mean this as any shade on any game, but it was almost the opposite approach that I got with a lot of like 90s era role-playing heavy books, where it was like, we're going to tell you these mechanics, but then we're going to show you what this very detailed story looks like in the setting. And we don't want you to think about it as a game. We want you to think about this story first and foremost, and then we'll dole out a few more mechanics and maybe you'll string them all together.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, you're probably, I mean, okay, that's just a good point. I mean, I think Jonathan and I are both pretty heavily oriented towards that this particular game is giving people an experience as a game that they need to be able to like think about and change if they don't like, you know, when I get playtest reports from people who say, I'm playing it your way and it sucks and none of us are having a good time, you know, I'm like, well, thank you for the information, but you could have stopped playing it that way and done it. You know, it's not, I'm really glad you told me, and it's never going to be like that. You don't have to keep on hitting your head against a wall. You know, that doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. And it, like you'll have, and I think some fans really want there to be, okay, fans want there to be a rule often. Some do, you know, and a lot of times when I'm hearing the debates about a rule, both Jonathan and I are a little bit like, does this even matter? I mean, I guess it does, you know, but, and I guess we, you know, and I can say that my honest answer sometimes is, well, you could play it either this way and this is what it's going to accomplish, or you can play it this way and this is what it'll accomplish. They're both possible. Even in the second edition, Jonathan and I do not see eye to eye about how to actually roll your icon relationships. And I guess I probably haven't written the sidebar that I'm probably not going to write about just how much I hated using his rule. he clearly isn't that fond of mine, so there we are.
Well, I was gonna say, like, after I've been running and playing fifth edition for 10 years now, so I have a better idea of, if I change this, it's going to cascade into all of these things. But that's not evident when you first look at the game. And what I like about the sidebars in 13th Age is you come right out and say, if you change this, it's probably going to do this for the game, and I appreciate that.
Partly you have to be comfortable with making analysis. Partly you have to be comfortable possibly being wrong. For example, although people love the sidebars, I can certainly tell you that a huge number of them, like if we were to take a black magic marker, take a copy of 13th Age we didn't actually care about, and strike out all the sidebar comments that actually are either irrelevant or wrong, or not all that helpful, there's be a lot of blacks breakout in the first edition, you know, because there were things we were writing saying, you know, there's even a part where the icons were like, hey man, there's an awful lot of you out there, and by the time you're playing this, you know, you'll probably have played the game more than us, so maybe you'll have a better version. Yeah, that's really helpful, designer, but that's how it was.
I appreciate that about it. So what are some of your favorite rules that you've come up with that are just in 13th Age, and how have they changed or survived into second edition?
Favorite rules and things, I think we partly already mentioned, because the escalation die is a big one. Backgrounds and skill checks, where you tell everybody who you were in the past, and you know, you tell them what your jobs were, and if you were a military chef, then you're going to get to apply those skill points not only to cooking, but maybe also to some military maneuvers and to like intimidating underlings and things like that. So there's an element of that I really like. And I like the unique thing. That was something we really never would have felt comfortable doing, working for a company like Wizards that wanted to have organized play and, you know, something like a one unique thing, sadly, is kind of anathema. I don't know. Look, I hope they do it, you know, but it's also, it's deliberately telling people that the story of your campaign is what's important, and you can don't pay attention to this canon. If you want to be the God Emperor, the former God Emperor who's being reincarnated, and you know, and your last life was as a ferret, and you're really pretty angry about that, you know, and that's your one unique thing. It's like, that's good, you know, and you're telling the game master what you want the campaign to be about. Those things are not hugely different in the second edition. the major, I mean, the thing is there's changes all over. I thought I was just going to be doing a little balance pass, but that's not what happened. but it's still fully compatible with the adventures and the supplements that came before. Mm-hmm. And I say fully compatible. Do people are playing monks and necromancers alongside the characters in second edition, and there's no problem. Mm-hmm. You could use Eyes of the Stone Thief, and as game master, you might just need to go ahead and rebuild some of the battles using the tables, mm-hmm. because we understand now that that as player characters are added to a table, it's exponential power, not mm-hmm. linear. And so, you know, the original building battle tables were way too easy. So it's compatible. My favorite stuff that has been added, I'm personally really fond of having done a bard I enjoy now. On the other hand, it's also the most complicated character in the book, and it's not mm-hmm. great for first level players, so I may have to address that a little bit. But it's really fun, and it's musical, and it's adventurous, and it's surprising, so that's fun.
I never got to play a bard, but I did get to play a ranger, and those are my two favorite character classes, and I really liked the ranger that I played.
Did you play a ranger recently?
No, it was a couple years ago when I played.
Well, I gotta tell you, the ranger is different now. and I'm happy about it. And here's one example. The ranger's animal companion before was basically just a, let's call it a inferior player character that sat on the table, sucking mm-hmm. up oxygen and getting in the way, and also, you know, being pretty powerful by sucking up damage. The ranger's animal companion now is much more like, you invoke it 1 to 3 or 4 times per arc, and when you use it, it's really powerful and it sticks around for a turn, but it's not always on the table. And mm-hmm. it's not always you getting extra turns when other people are sitting there waiting for you. That was a change, and I just finally, we had the epic level playtest when the ranger had an animal companion and it was just like a giant sack of hit points. I was like, no, this is just wasting everybody's time. Hopefully that new ranger approach works.
I'll be very interested to see it. I mean, one of my hobbies is just seeing how people reinterpret rangers for every version of fantasy.
Oh, this is going to be pretty major for you, okay? Because I sort of went back to thinking, what is a ranger? And the answer is, I came up with, I've got talents. 13th age, you get 3 talents to start. Mm-hmm. And those really define your character. And I said, some talents are warrior talents. Some talents are hunter talents. Some talents are magician talents. Both the warrior and the hunter talents, they give you something, and they also give you another use of a very powerful ability. Lethal hunter for the lethal hunter and skirmisher for the warrior. And as a result, the warrior, who is a class who only chooses talents, actually mm-hmm. gets to make a fair number of interesting choices during play. Maybe not as many during setup, but during mm-hmm. play, the character actually has more to do. It's probably more powerful than it was, because I got tired of watching the ranger character in my game cry. I don't know if I even admit that. Yeah, whatever. I mean, it was at a point where, but when he would show up, I would just be like, I would just make up abilities and give it to him. Be like, here's your character. You can do this really cool thing, you know, because you're not happy with this ranger character. And the fact that you're so far from happy with it means I got to do something. So we did.
I was happy with my ranger because I did use that one unique thing to basically be a secret love affair that the elf queen was having, because he was just this himbo human that looked like Kristoff from Frozen. Not super bright, but a good person that kind of knew wood lore. And I took the sorcerer talent.
Oh yeah.
And
magic magician, fae queen's enchantments.
Yeah. And the whole thing with that was he wasn't casting that. That was her looking out for him and nice. Getting him out of trouble when he was too stupid to realize he was in trouble.
That's awesome. I really love that. That's good. That's good. That does help set a campaign running, especially if there's other people who really think that they're more deserving. You never deserved her. Yeah, that's good. Well, you can still have that character.
So. That's good.
Yep.
I will look forward to that.
Magic champions still work for you.
Which classes and which species are making it into this? Is it going to be the same ones that were in the core book?
We're pulling the same canon classes. I mean, partially, this is a matter of scope. Also, the other classes that have been added to the game so far were in 13 True Ways and the Book of Demons. Oh, and 13th Age Glorantha. So mm-hmm. all those classes were designed after the core. They need less of an update. I mean, there's the possible exception. There's exceptions to that. I mean, like the Druid, who knows? I'm not really sure. I attempted to tell a druid, to tell multiple druid stories, and I'm not sure how many people really came along. I'm not sure how many people played druids in 13th Age. I'm not positive about that.
We didn't have one at our table, I will say that much.
I've had playtesting ones, but I haven't been around that many. So that is one of those weird things where when you sort of at the end of a cycle realize nobody's playing that. There's pro in you know, and it's there's an issue.
I
Whereas
was
people
tempted to
are
play
coming.
Necromancer.
Well, necromancers, monks, demonologists, they tend to get played. Did you say you played one, Necromancer?
No, I was tempted to play one though. That was the other thing besides Ranger that I was like, yeah, I might want to do this.
I can see that. It's fun. So those classes will be updated. I call the book that I'm working on, well, I'm not working on it yet. I always am putting pieces of it in a file. Further Adventurers, and Further Adventurers will have a bunch of classes. And it won't just be full classes. It won't be, when you do a full class, you're doing something like the fighter, the wizard, the ranger, and you're saying there's multiple possible versions of this character. This class is an archetype that people are not only familiar with and expect in gaming, they also want to have different versions of them. There's a bow fighter, for example, in second edition now, and there wasn't before. But Further Adventurers will have room for things that, you know, this is an interesting character to play. If you play this character, it'll be a lot of fun, and the table will be really interesting, and everybody's going to have fun with that. The Ice Mage does not require multiple versions of itself. You know, it just doesn't. It's like, no, this is it. Enjoy it, you know. And if somebody else plays an Ice Mage at your table, what are they? Your twin? Come on. Maybe don't
Yeah,
do
some
that.
things are more unique than others.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. It could be. That's an yeah. Some of those classes, I am the only Ice Mage, is a really easy, unique. Well, you should do it. Yeah, it won't be quite as much like that as Jonathan's Occultist in 13 True Ways.
I was just about to say, I don't think I ever fully wrapped my head around what I would do if I were playing an occultist.
I got to watch Jonathan, like our there's a campaign I run called Spearpoint, where all the player characters are dwarven deviants of one type or another. And Jonathan was a his comp idea of a deep dwarf or something. But he was also the occultist, but he called it something different. I got to watch him play it, and it was pretty funny because I think at the level that we were playing, the character didn't do much. It's sort of like always like, I'm waiting to use my magnificent power. My power is barely noticed by anyone at the table. And it was pretty funny because the character got better than that as it went up a bit. But it was also like Jonathan just putting his head in his hands and going, oh my God, I don't know what I was thinking. You know, and so you get to that. I mean, my characters, look, I'm going to mock Jonathan about this. My players mock me by saying, hey, I don't know what I'm playing tonight, but Rob, I want to play whatever you just designed because it'll be the most broken, you know. Guys.
What I like though is I don't feel like that is a thing where it's like, oh, they really messed up this class, because you know the way it was described, it is swinging for the fences. This
Yeah,
is not meant to be
there are
something that
times.
you would play instead of a wizard or a cleric. This is
Oh, the
something
occultist,
you're
absolutely.
playing something completely
Yeah, you're
different
playing
if you're
something
doing
completely
this.
different. And it's because the occultist play style is always to be waiting for other people to do something. And it has a hang fire where it's like saying, all right, now, if by the beginning of my turn, nothing has happened, that I could react to, then I will do this. But it's a different play style. And that's one of the things that 13th Age tries to do. It tries to make it so that different characters really play differently. And nobody else really plays like the occultist. The battle captain, what's it called? Battle captain? The commander style guy. Captain, I'm sorry, warlord. My life is full of them.
Yeah, I was gonna say I've
They
had too
also
many in too many different systems to
do a
remember.
lot of things. They do a lot of stuff on other people's turns. The bard is complex in this new edition because it knows musical instruments, three instruments: brass, strings, voice, dance. It gets a miss me effect from each one of those instruments. So if somebody attacks, and it gets a combat riff, meaning if they hit with melee from each one of those instruments. And so there's things that the bard is reacting to multiple times, potentially each round. And then again, sometimes it just never happens in that round. And so that's the characters that are interesting to play, most interesting to play in terms of like keeping, you know, if you're on your phone and you miss the chance to go, you know, sorry, I'm everybody. I was like busy texting. Did we? Oh, are you dead? I'm so sorry. Yeah, whoops. And it's also one of the reasons why one of the things I'm going to be working on, not immediately, but definitely before this comes out, is character sheets. I want to have a sheet that specifically reflects characters that have a lot of reactive powers and they're keeping track of when they can use them. You know, different characters need that more than others. The barbarian sheet doesn't need it very much, and the bard needs it a lot. We'll be doing something to match those.
I mean, that's been another thing that I really appreciate about the ongoing commentary in the book is some games do have that idea that this class is easier to play than this class, but it's not really in the rule book that it tells you this one is easier than this one to play. And that's why I appreciate
it. Why not?
Well, and that's why I appreciate 13th Age just saying, if you don't want a complicated character, this is what you should play. I really appreciate that.
I'm glad you do. A lot of people do. There are others who are like, please don't give me any simple characters at all. And they may be right in the sense that, like, if you have a simple version, maybe you could also have a more complex version. But sometimes we get to the point where we're just like, we got a simple version of this. It's mainly simple. That's what's going to stay. Mm-hmm. But the rest, I think in this particular, in the second edition, some of the characters that only had simple versions now have versions that do have more choices about how to play and still have the simple version that's possible. I'm also going to try to get pre-gen characters that are the simplest ones available for people when they start. Look, if you've got new players who don't want to have to make a character, this is a very simple version of the fighter. This is the very simple version of the paladin, or at least it's as simple as it can be, you know, so I'll try that. Yeah, it is interesting. It's a philosophical question to me. If you know as a designer that these things are easier and those things are harder, why not say so? And maybe some people do.
Well, and what's interesting is I have heard designers say, like if you interview them and say, what's the easiest class to play? They will say it, but it's not in the rule book. So unless you're someone like some of us that are like terminally online and following all of the game designers that we actually, you know, like, you know, you're not hearing that, you know, this is the one that's easier than this one or anything like that.
Okay, look, I'm just going to make a guess, and it could be totally wrong, but cultures teach us how to act. Very few games go ahead and tell you what's easy. It's not traditional to go ahead and have that information easily available to people, so it's not part of the language. It's also possibly the case that esoterica, it's like gamers, some gamers have enjoyed games that they were smart enough to figure out and other people weren't. I don't know how much of a thing that is anymore. There's so many more people playing interesting, simple story games that, you know, encourage interaction and relationships with each other and stuff like that, that maybe that's going away. And those games don't have as much demands on this is really hard and this is really easy.
Well, and some of those are even a little bit more likely to say, like Monster of the Week, which I love dearly. There are a few playbooks that they say these are more complicated than others, but it says it in the book.
And that's what should happen,
mm-hmm.
I think. The funny part about it is when you get a reputation for being helpful, sometimes people don't notice when you're not. It's like, I know that we really try to be helpful, but I also know that, for instance, there were some monsters in the first edition that were really complicated. Sort of like, wait, I thought I said that I was only doing a couple powers per monster. What is this guy? Ooh, breaks the rules. Okay. I guess that's okay. I think this edition, you know, just speaking of monsters, for example, really moved away from abilities that were just there because they felt like something should be there to abilities that are actually have an interesting impact on play. And for that, I think I'll thank Jonathan, because I don't think he was involved with the original monster design much at all. And this time around, Jonathan really was. Every single week, it'd be another like, wait a minute. Oh, this guy does that now. Oh, okay, all right. You know, that's interesting. So yeah, we've got the monsters are updated in ways that will make them feel more different from each other. I don't know if people noticed how many things were a little bit vanilla in the core book, but they're not anymore.
I mean, that's another thing I really appreciated too, was that you have the base stat block, but then so many of them have, if you want this thing to be tougher,
nastier specials. Yes.
I love that.
Right. And I know people who, you know, like part of the slogan for the campaign, the Game Master is, all Nasty Year specials every time. I was like, oh my goodness. Okay. Well, this core book may you can always flee. That was a funny thing. Nobody ever fled. Fleeing is a rule in 13th Age that says if there's one player character who's conscious, everybody can escape from the battle. Something will happen that you manage to get away. You can tell a story if you want to, or if it's just too much trouble, hand wave and the curtain comes back and you got away. Fine. But in the old days, it was phrased as you take a campaign loss. Nobody wanted to do it. People, like a lot of times, people is like, well, we're going to die and we'll all just die, you know? Because, and some part of me wondered if is it the words campaign loss? Do they think they lost the campaign? So what we did is we changed it to it's not a narrative setback. I think it's still a narrative loss, but it's part of the narrative. It's part of how the story goes wrong for a while. It's not the campaign being lost. I think the funny part is I have this funny feeling. This is one of those little linguistic things is that I've heard people now thinking, okay, should we flee? And I'm like, that conversation didn't happen before.
When my friends and I went to see the second Hobbit movie, when the
I never
whole thing
saw it,
went.
by the way, because Peter Jackson chase scenes, yada 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 yada
Yeah.
yada, just drive me nuts.
I understand, but what was funny about it was after they did all of the completely pointless extra stuff that wasn't in the book that took like 45 minutes, after
Yeah.
they did all of that and Smaug takes off and they don't fight Smaug, they don't try and kill him and everything, and Smaug flies off and torches Lake Town, I was like, they retreated.
Right. They retreated. And I think, did we change the word to retreat? Maybe we did.
I feel bad because sometimes I pull terms from other games because I review so much stuff and then it's like, wait, is this from this game or is this from this one?
Well,
I know what the concept is.
it's pretty funny because you're right. I mean, and you know, Magic the Gathering, what did they what was it, Tap, right? That's the original. They owned it. So everybody had to be like, oh, you're not tapping that card, you're turning it or you're tweedling it. So the fact that I'm sitting here unable to get my term straight, I'm a little bit amused because it's like it's what happens when you work on an edition and we changed it to retreat. There's no more fleeing.
I accidentally got
You got it. Well,
it
oh, I know you studied really hard for this interview.
right.
Yeah, you just digested the whole of the Gamma playtest packet. Well done. Yes, fleeing is now retreating, and a campaign loss is now a narrative loss.
I think in the intervening time, like you were saying, a lot more people have been playing more narrative games. And I think some of those games have helped people understand what it means. Like, if you do this and a setback happens, let's talk about what the stakes are. It looks
All
like
right.
this. Do you want to do it? And that's,
Yeah.
I think that's become more prevalent since, the beginning when some of us first read these rules when they first came out and went, I don't know what that means.
I
How
mean,
bad is the GM going to mess with us if we do
oh yeah.
that?
Okay, so second edition has a lot more examples. I mean, and by a lot more, I mean here I could just re let me just rephrase that sentence. Hey, second edition has examples. Oh God.
Oh,
Oh
goodness.
man. Oh geez. Okay, I'm saying oh geez because I'm just like tapping into sort of the toothache style hurt I felt when I went back and read the actual what we'd actually written for the icon relationship rules in first edition, and I found the key rule that somehow everybody seemed to be missing, like stuck in one paragraph as not and not the topic sentence. And I was like, what have I done? Every time I would talk to a 13th Age game master who was really having fun with it, a lot of times I would remember to ask, and what are you doing for icon relationships? And they would tell me it would never ever match up with what anybody else was doing. Because it was like a half-designed mechanic, I guess. We just weren't really clear enough. So, second edition has an entire chapter that starts with, instead of one-page discussions of the icons, it has, I don't know, 3 or 4 pages. And they're very much written from the perspective of how would this feed into your character using icon connections? Not this is the gay guy in the world. It's no, how is this relevant to player characters? And then it goes into, I don't know, probably 30 or, I don't know if it's 30 or 40 once Arc gets added, pages of examples of icon connections and all the different techniques that, that players might be able to use to narrate them. And
that's neat. I like that.
We didn't do it. And now, no, now we know. We've done it. We were able to like ask a bunch of people for their favorite cases of interesting times that had happened. We mined those. We used ours. We made up a couple. Gareth Ryder Hanrahan heard, you know, when I said I was doing it, turned around and the next day sent me a list of 13, which Gar. Yeah.
I mean, that's actually one of the things, one of the other books that I really enjoyed was Book of Ages with all of the talking about the different icons and different eras and everything. I love that book. That was great.
I think that's my favorite book in the line of like, you know, and I, you know, whatever. I obviously I love my babies, but you know, Gar's Book of Ages is hilarious. What an amazing amount of fun stuff for 13th Age campaigns. And I've used it a lot. I love the cover, like that I got to like figure out the Grandmaster of Flowers. Like, I don't know if people know that's who it is, but that's, I think they do if they look at the icon symbols. And so, yeah, so that was a wonderful book. Gar really kicked butt on it. Mm-hmm. Did you, have you, like, this is, I'm not trying, I have not used its campaign background creation thing about all the previous ages. Because that's not really how I need to, I don't need that to run games. So I'm just asking, when people say they love it, do you mainly love the second two-thirds of the book, which is the ages, or did you also use the first part?
Here's the bad thing. 13th Age is one of the few games, much like 4th edition, that I have played and not run.
Right.
I mean, and that does not happen much with me.
Oh, yeah, good. Right, congratulations. Well done. All right.
Yeah, but, so book- I mean... I'm used to reading through books because I do a lot of reviews and I loved reading it. It was just a pleasure to read through.
Oh, it's so good. Book of Ages is wonderful. Right now, J.M. DeFogy is playtesting and developing Gar's new adventure. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as thick as Eyes of the Stone Thief, but it's close and it goes levels 1 through 10. So there's another Gar book waiting in the wings and I'm really excited for that. Book of Ages is one of those, and you know, there's an example of why I needed the second edition to stay compatible. I mean, I didn't want to make people buy a second edition version of Eyes of the Stone Thief.
Yeah.
Or Book of Ages. I don't want to republish the bestiaries. The irony is, if the system didn't work, well, I guess I would have been comfortable like going ahead and, you know, doing that. But then again, I probably have no right to, given that the system didn't work. So it is odd to me because I recognize that like other many other people involved in gaming, they don't have any problem saying buy the books, and the fans don't either, I guess, you know, for the most part. But I just personally cannot see scrapping a bookshelf of books that are fun.
I don't mind buying a non-compatible new edition if that non-compatible new edition does what the first thing did better.
Oh, got it. Okay. All right.
But yeah, I'll buy revised things all the time because, you know, I have no impulse control.
Well, you're in luck this time, I guess, because when you buy new things for 13th Age 2nd Edition, they actually will be new. And they, you know, I guess the 13 True Ways classes will violate that, but I don't think I'm actually going to republish 13 True Ways because the other stuff in the book is, it seems more likely that those classes will be part of the book, that Further Adventurers book.
It is really interesting to me, though, because I kickstarted 13 True Ways.
Yeah.
And that book is one of those. There's a few books that remind me of how I felt when I got Unearthed Arcana when I was younger. And by Unearthed Arcana, I mean, I'm old. I mean, the first edition of Unearthed Arcana. And 13 True Ways reminded me a lot of that feeling in Unearthed Arcana where it's like, oh, this is all stuff that reminds me of what I like in the game and then also adds a whole ton of other stuff to it.
That was the intention. And the weird part about it is, I suspect I'm older than you. Both Jonathan and I were probably, my guess is Arduin Grimoire predates Unearthed Arcana. Oh yeah, it has to.
Yeah.
That was our Arduin Grimoire style book. Everything and the kitchen sink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not like holding back. If we want it in the book, it's in the book because that's a book. It's a book. All of stuff. The name of the book, you know where that's from, right?
It escapes me at the moment.
Gary Gygax had written a famous editorial in which he said there was one true way to play D&D.
Yeah. No, I definitely appreciate that. So what is going in the player's guide versus the game master's guide, since that's kind of a new thing with the core books?
Player's guide has character creation, akin character classes, the rules for icon connections, because those are very much in the player's hands, not mm-hmm. the GM's hands. The player now is responsible for adding narration to the story using that. It's not the GM. The GM gets involved if the player rolls a twist. Not otherwise, no. And the rules, like the basic rules for combat. So that's the player's book. And then the Game Master's Guide starts with stuff on the Dragon Empire, goes to the rules for setting up campaigns and running the game. Then monsters, and then treasure, and then an intro adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the biggest reasons we did it is because of the word I just used, biggest. Pellgrane really did not want to publish a book that was over 400 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think they've done it. It wasn't fun,
yeah.
And it doesn't work well.
I can understand that.
So realistically, in order for a table to play the game, they need both books. To play your character, you may not need the Game Master's Guide.
Yeah, I was going to say, just what you've been talking about here, about what you're expanding on and what you're spending the extra 20 pages on here and there.
Yeah.
I can definitely, like, I wasn't doubting that you could fill both of them and make them both useful, but it did definitely show me, like, you're expanding on these concepts that you introduced, but maybe didn't spell out quite as much.
The Hero's Handbook, which is what we're calling it now, is going to be bigger. Half again, the size. Maybe a little more. And that's partially because the character class chapter is a monster. Also because all those pages of examples for the icon connections, that's all in the player's book. The examples that are in the Game Master's Guide are examples of setting up campaigns. That's pretty much it, though. There's probably some other examples I'm forgetting. But really, most of the examples... I think the explanations for Game Masters were a little better to begin with.
Unfortunately, I don't want my editor to skewer me, so I need to start wrapping up, but I have to ask you, what did the Orc King do to get offed?
Okay, there's several answers to that question. One answer that immediately occurs to me is he just wasn't very interesting. And you could blame us for that. Like, one of the things about the icons is, okay, they're fantasy archetypes, but they're not supposed to be just archetypes. They're supposed to be archetypes the player characters want to be involved with. Although there are many people who were like, oh, the Orc Lord was part of my campaign, and I did have relationships with them in this way, compared to the other icons, less so, I think. And we just didn't do much with them. You know, this force of destruction from an earlier age that may have been created by the elves and yada, you know, there was something there, but it was very Tolkien-esque. It didn't wow us. And on top of that, orcs, not the greatest monsters, got an awful lot of baggage. And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Carrying that baggage directly into the icons? No.
Yeah.
It was like, do we need him? No, we don't.
I've definitely heard more people talk about even figuring out how to connect their characters to the Diabolist or the Crusader, which are villainous icons.
The Diabolist and the Crusader have interesting... Okay.
Yeah.
Here's another way to look at it. Imagine we'd set up the Orc Lord at first as sort of a horde magician, like ogre mm-hmm. mage style person. Well, that person would have magic and stuff like that. As we phrased the Orc Lord from the beginning, it's like, hello, I've got two axes and I like to burn things. You know, it's not, you know, whereas a crusader will get you, I enslave demons and I worship the dark gods, and you might enjoy that. So there's a lot more depth there. So the truth is, we had a choice. Put effort into creating depth on something that we didn't really want to do anyway. So we mm-hmm. didn't. Yeah. Took it out.
Oh, yeah. I can definitely understand that, but I just, I noticed the poor guy was gone, so.
And now I'll make the joke answer. Well, you see, Lee Moyer has this killer idea for the GM screen, and it's a four-panel GM screen with three icons per panel, and somebody's got to go.
Nice.
Yep.
So is there any last thing that you would want to impart to people looking into 13th Age that you want them to know about second edition? Anything to wrap up here?
Oh man, I mean, I could just plug it and say, if you haven't gotten on board, you can. Pellgrane is going to be selling it on Backer Kit the Kickstarter, I think I noticed the other day, was still like letting people pledge, I thought. It
Yeah.
hadn't been turned off. And I was like, oh, okay. And I think what we did with originally with like trying to make it a toolbox for people who want interesting ways of helping their F20 games, that's still true. And possibly now that the icon connections actually make sense, much more so with this edition. One of the things that I really have to spend a little effort on later is I'm going to write some introductory stuff for people coming from other editions of the game. It's not going to be in the core book, but it'll be somewhere. Mm. That'll be a lot of fun. I think there's a bunch of interesting editions of F20 rolling games coming soonish.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly have not. One thing I haven't done, I haven't really looked at those. I'm much more in the sort of like finishing our thing in style. I'm really happy about the art and the way it's turning out. I think it's going to be very, very exciting and different than, you know, somewhat different than it was in the core book. And thank you for this interview. I did so many of these like right during the Kickstarter. It's very nice to come in a much more relaxed, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to help you promote things, but I also like just being able to talk about a subject.
Yeah, that's fine. I think it's good.
We really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. I look forward to seeing what you've come up with and getting a chance to talk to you again.
Talk to me about the Ranger.
This show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can become a patron backer by following the Patreon link on the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this, so our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnome Cast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network. So if you're enjoying us, here's another show you should check out. Panda's Talking Games. We're gamers talking about tabletop role-playing games and making outtakes. Join Panda's Phil and Senda every other Wednesday answering listener questions about playing, running, and designing TTRPGs. It's like Car Talk, but for your games. You can find all of us at GnomeStew.com along with GnomeStew on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads.